whose weekend is ruined. If it's due on Monday, it's your weekend. If it's due on Friday, it's mine. And it's...
I like turning it in on Fridays.
Yeah, I mean, then it's out of the way. Yeah.
I like having
yeah.
weekends.
Yeah.
I usually spend my weekends or the next week somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Okay. So, this new homework, problem one, is about another thing, how one can interpret the Möbius function. You can count it as an alternate count over chains in the post set. And not disjoint chains, but just total number of chains. And what this allows you, then that's basically part B, is if you revert your post set, so you revert your ordering, two elements are not ordered also in the new ordering, they are not, but otherwise you revert it, that will just take the Hasse diagram and turn it upside down. And if you count chains, a chain before is a chain afterwards. That means the Möbius function is invariant under this flipping the lattice. Problem 40a, and this is again part A, because it's problem 40 also has an A. Yeah, that's bad naming. Anyhow, that doesn't have a new number because I will not count it for the total. That is for those of you who had algebraic topology. What one can do is, if one has a post set, one can build a simplicial complex for this post set. And what is a simplicial complex? That in topology, this is something to describe a space. The simplest thing which you can use to enclose an area is a triangle, to enclose a space is a tetrahedron, and so on. And these things are called simplices. And what you might have is that you have some object where you have, say, certain triangles, and they, on a tetrahedron, on the faces you have triangles, the triangles have edges, the edges have endpoints. That's respectively 3, 2, 1, 0 dimensional spaces. And you have an obvious relation that, say, a face sits on the tetrahedron, an edge sits on a face, and so on. And you don't necessarily have the whole hierarchy. You could have holes in your object, right? If you put another face in here, you would have a hole in the middle. And that hole, that's what topology is interested in. Counting holes and generalizations of holes, because that tells you the hollow object is different than the full object. And the simplicial complexes are just a way to discretize the problem. Anyhow, so if one has a post set, one could build a simplicial complex where you consider the vertices, the one-dimensional objects would be the elements of the post sets, and then chains of varying length are the faces. Chain of length 3 would be the equivalent of a triangle, and so on. And that satisfies the axioms of a simplicial complex. And for a simplicial complex, one can define something which is called the Euler characteristic. And it turns out up to this factor minus 1, which one can even argue away by taking the reduced Euler characteristic, it turns out the Möbius function for this complex is exactly the Euler characteristic. The Möbius function for the post set is for the whole post set is exactly the Euler characteristic of this complex. So that connects the concept of the Möbius function with some concept from topology. Problem 41 is relatively straightforward. That's just to calculate the Möbius function for a particular case. And there probably the defining formula is the easiest way of doing it. Problem 42 is a variant of Hall's theorem. It's actually something which comes from Hall's original paper. It's a special case that you have two partitions of a set and you do this. And part 42B is an application, well, which initially might look a little bit surprising. You can show that in a finite group, if you have a subgroup, well, if a subgroup is normal, you know that left cosets are equal to right cosets. If it is not normal, they are different. But you can still find a simultaneous set of representatives, elements which are representatives of the right cosets and representatives of the left cosets, though the cosets are different. And that follows immediately from part A. And problem 43 is just to give some example that you can't expect for holds in for selecting a system of distinct representatives, that you would build this one by one, that you would leave one of the sets out, find a system of distinct representatives, and then just add one. There are situations where this cannot succeed, where you really need to go and unravel your previous choice. So that's what the homework problems are also. Thank you that. Yeah. Are there questions? And also just as a reminder once more, if you feel the homework in this class is unduly easy or unduly difficult, please say so. It's not intended for this class to fall completely out of line with other classes of 500 level math, but if it does, don't be shy in saying so. Okay. Let me start with correction or modification. I said last time, if you want to select a system of distinct representatives, the situation can be complicated in that you might have to try out a lot. Okay. So that is if you have n sets and you just look at this parameter n. If you actually want to look at formal complexity, you can't just count the number of sets, but you also have to count the sizes of the sets. And basically, in the situations where it behaves badly, the sizes of the sets have to be large. And that makes the problem, in the end, a polynomial time problem. Indeed, we will see a method for, matchings in bipartite graphs, but basically that is nothing else. That is one way how one could get such a system of distinct representatives, and there are polynomial time algorithms which solve this. So, yes, you might need to unravel things, and indeed that would also happen in the algorithm, but because this will happen only in the case of large sets, it keeps the problem a polynomial type problem. Okay. And there I think I was a little bit confused last time. So, what did we do last time? We did prove the Koenig-Ejavari theorem. The idea was we have a matrix with zeros and ones. We assume in that matrix without loss of generality, and we want to cover that matrix with lines which go through rows or columns so that every one is touched by one of these lines. And in the proof we had seen without loss of generality, let's assume the lines are on the top and to the right. And the theorem said the minimal number of lines covering, that's exactly the term rank, and the term rank is the cardinality of a maximal independent set, so this is a set of entries which are one, so that no two of them lie in the same row or the same column. And the proof, which went a little bit rushed towards the end, was basically saying, okay, let's first look at these rows here. We want to find, if we have R rows, we want to find R entries here which are independent. And our argument was, If there are R rows, they must have entries in at least R different columns. If not, we can leave one of the rows out and replace it by, we could remove the rows, replace them by columns, and have thereby a cover of smaller size. So, we have these rows, and then Hall's theorem gave us that we can find a system of distinct representatives for these rows, distinct meaning they will be column indices for every row at one column and this index, and they're all different, which makes these entries independent. And similarly, we can do this thing here and thereby get as many independent entries as we have lines, showing that indeed this is reached. On the other hand, we need at least as many lines as the size. That was obvious, that if we have an independent set to cover just that independent set, we need as many lines as there are entries, right? Because no two of them lie on the same line. So the fact that this is actually reached is proving the theorem. The minimum number of lines covering is the maximal size of an independent set. Okay. I want to reformulate this theorem now in the different setting, and that's the setting of graphs. So for that, I need the definition of a bipartite graph. A graph, gamma, with vertices and edges is bipartite if we can partition the vertices into two parts. Into the vertices would be vertex set 1, disjoint union vertex set 2, so that the edges are always just between these two sets, so that no two vertices in V1 respectively in V2 are connected. So what you have is you have what a bipartite graph typically models are two different kinds of objects. You have a set of people and you have some set of jackets, and the jackets fit certain people, and you draw an edge if the jacket fits that person. And what you want to do is you want to, say, give the maximum number of people a jacket which fits, and you try to find such a situation. And there are a lot of practical problems which are of that flavor, where you're trying to find such maximum connections. So, let me give you an example, because I think that will make it easiest to understand. Example, let's take, I have here in both parts four vertices, though there is no condition that it has to be the same number. Why don't I put another one there just to make sure it's a different number? Let's have some edges. That is some example of a bipartite graph. And yeah, it could be people and jobs, what they're qualified with, or you could have the situation of finding a system of distinct representatives. These are the elements, these are the sets, and the line is there if the element is in the set. So, what else do I want to define a vertex cover. A vertex cover is a set of vertices such that every edge is adjacent to at least one vertex in the cover. So, for example, I could pick this vertex, and this vertex. That would be a vertex cover, right? Every edge is adjacent. It might be adjacent to two of them, but every edge is adjacent to at least one of these vertices. Yes?
Every edge is adjacent, or every vertex is adjacent?
Every edge is, well, that actually I shouldn't say adjacent, incident. I should say incident, yes, sorry. Every edge is incident with one of these marked vertices. Then it is, then we call it a vertex cover. Of course, I can add further vertices and it keeps the cover property. So we will be interested in vertex covers of minimal size. Okay. And we have a dual in some way, well, we will see in a moment, this is a dual property that is a matching. A matching is a set of edges, edges no two incident with the same vertex. So, for example, let's pick some matching, let's say I pick this edge and this edge. That would be some matching, right? These edges are not meeting the same vertex. If I would also add this edge, that would violate the property. Okay. And if I have a matching and I take edges out, it remains a matching, so we will be interested in matchings of maximal size. Okay. And given where we are, the result itself will probably not be surprising. The theorem we will get... and I should say that we have no... Oh, we assume that we don't have isolated vertices, so sorry, let's leave that thing. The isolated vertices, or do we need to? Well, they don't really do harm, but well, they don't participate. So, finding matchings of maximal size clearly is something which is of interest. That's a lot of practical problems. Having a set of people with certain qualifications and a set of jobs. You want to get as many people into jobs. How do you assign them the task? Or as many tasks as possible done, how do you assign the tasks to people? So, and so an obvious question is, how can I find a maximum matching? And Yeah, the theorem we will have will basically be a way towards going there. So this is theorem for 5, and that theorem is due to Koenig. It typically goes under the name of Koenig's theorem. In a bipartite graph, graph without isolated vertices, the number of edges in a maximum matching equals the number of vertices in a minimum vertex cover. Okay. Clearly, if we clearly the number of vertices in a vertex cover needs to be at least as large as the number of edges in a maximum matching, because if you could cover with fewer, you would take that if you take a matching, a vertex cover can have only what a vertex cover needs to cover all edges, so it needs to cover all edges in a matching, which is just a subset of edges. And in the best case, best coverage, we don't cover two ends of the same edge. That means we would have at least one vertex in a cover for every edge. That means the fact that this inequality, this is trivial. But in fact, they are the same. Okay. And I want to prove this. And the proof will just reduce it to the Koenig-Iagvari theorem, which we've proven last time. And then with that, the proof becomes very easy. So let's look at this bipartition. Here I call them W and U, be the parts of the bipartition. So I have W here, I have U there, and let's assume W has size M. This is very clever, inconsistent choice of variable names. U have size N, and I describe adjacency in a matrix. Matrix A, which is a 0-1 matrix, and I want it to be an M cross N matrix. When do I put a 1 in? I put a 1 in if two vertices are adjacent, right? So Aij is equal to 1 if and only if Wi is adjacent to Uj. Okay. What you might, well, you can't notice it here because I don't have the example, but unless I've made a mistake, that graph corresponds exactly to the example of the 0-1 matrix I had last time as example for the Koenig-Iagvari theorem. So you should be able to see the correspondence there. Okay, so what is the matching in the graph? matching in the graph, I claim corresponds to an independent set in A, right? It's a set of ones in A. Every one in A corresponds to one edge of the graph. What does independence mean? They are not adjacent, not in the same, no two of them are in the same row. Being in the same row would mean they would be adjacent to the same vertex in W, nor in the same column, so no two of them are adjacent to the same vertex in U. So that is the matching property. Edges which do not share common vertices. So, what does a vertex cover correspond to? Well, a vertex cover is a set of vertices so that every edge is covered, right? So, I want to select vertices. A vertex corresponds to a row or a column of this adjacency matrix. And I want that every one is covered. The ones are the edges, so that every edge is adjacent to one of these vertices. So a vertex cover corresponds to a line cover of A. And now we just use the theorem, previous theorem. It says the maximum matching size, that's the maximal size of an independent set, is equal to the size of a minimum cover. And that's the theorem I want to prove. Okay. So that's the proof of Koenig's theorem, and yeah, basically the Koenig-Egavari theorem is just a different, they're really the same theorem, they're just slightly different formulations. So we know that gives us a criterion for the size of a maximum matching. In this case we have a matching of size 2, but we have an independent set. We have vertex cover of size 3. So either there must be a smaller vertex cover or there must be a larger matching. In this case, it turns out there is a larger matching, and we'll construct the larger one in a little while. And yeah, as I mentioned a couple of times, this is a problem of practical relevance called the assignment problem. How can one solve this? And there is a method, well, there are multiple methods for solving this. The one I want to show you is called, not by the original, it's called the Hungarian method. It was called that way by someone in the 1950s because it uses the theorem of Koenig and some other theorems related, and they were all Hungarians who proved these theorems. So that's why it's called the Hungarian method. It turns out that this method is not actually new in that sense. There is an older source. There is a paper by Jacques Jacobi from the early 1800s. It's a paper on ordinary differential equations where he has to solve such an assignment problem. He says, oh, you can solve it in the following way, and that's basically the same method. But even without that, this has clearly practical applications. You want to, I don't know, get people into rooms or tourists onto different holidays or so. It's not hard to come up with examples where you want to maximize the size of a matching in a bipartite graph. So what I now want to do is to describe this this method to find a maximum matching. And what this method does is basically it starts with some matching, and it is, well, and either it is maximal or it is not. Well, this is not a very surprising result in itself, but it gives a criterion for when it uses this theorem to test whether it is maximal or not. You have take a vertex cover if you have a minimum vertex cover that tells you whether the you can know whether the matching is maximal. And crucially, it uses that vertex cover to increase the size of the matching. But the way it increases the size of the matching is not just to add a further edge. In this example, as I've drawn it there, you cannot add another edge. But it changes edges so that afterwards one more edge is in the matching. So that's how the process works. So for that, I need to describe that algorithm. I need to, well, define a few more terms. So let M as a subset of the edges be a matching in the graph gamma, which has vertices and edges. And I don't demand it to be a maximal matching. It's just some matching. It could be the empty matching. I can just start with no edges whatsoever in there, and that's fine. And an edge is matched if it is in the matching and it's otherwise free. And I just use these terms because that they make it easier to describe the algorithm. And the same for vertices. A vertex is matched if and only if it is incident with an edge E in the matching, if there is a matching edge going to the vertex. And again, free otherwise. Right, and now comes the crucial definition, an augmenting path. An augmenting path for M is a path whose endpoints are free and whose edges are alternatingly not matched and matched. So what does this mean? So how does this path look like? You have a free vertex, the end vertices are free. So I have a free vertex here. So the first edge in the path cannot be in the matching, because otherwise this would not be a free vertex, right? The next edge is matched. The next one is again free. The next edge is matched. The next one is free, and the endpoint is also free, so I have free edges on both sides. Okay. And if I have such an augmenting path, I can increase the size of the matching. Namely, I just flip the status of the edges in this path. So, if augmenting path flip the status of edges in the path, this increases the matching size. Right? So what I would do is I would instead make this edge part of the matching, this edge part of the matching, and this edge part of the matching. And because both endpoints are free and both end edges are free, this increases. When I do this flipping, I have more edges which are matched. And why can I do this? Why does this preserve the property of being a matching? Well, what I just need to check is that no two in the result, no two edges are ending in the same vertex. Right? And obviously, I just need to check this for my new edges. Can this edge, or let's first look at an edge in the middle, can this edge meet with some other edge in the matching? No, because these two vertices both were already incident with edges in the matching, so there cannot be another edge in the matching which would be incident with either of these two vertices. So if I take these two edges out and put that edge in instead, I have a matching. What about the edges at the end? Well, if this edge, well, at this vertex, for this vertex, the argument is the same. This is an inner vertex. The argument is the same as before. That was adjacent to an edge before. Yes, that edge has gone, but so no other edge could have been incident. And what about the vertices at the end? The assumption was these were free vertices. They were not adjacent to any edge, not incident to any edge in the matching. So I could put an edge on them without violating anything. So if I have an augmenting path, I can play this flipping game and everything is fine. I can flip, I have still a matching, and I end up with a matching which is of size one larger. So, for example, what I could do here is I could take this vertex is free, I take this edge not in the matching, edge in the matching, edge not in the matching, free vertex. That is an augmenting path, right? So what I could do is I would take that edge out of the matching, put instead that edge in, and I now have a matching not with two edges, but a matching with three edges. The vertex cover is still a vertex cover of size 3. I have a matching of size 3. The theorem tells me there can't be a larger matching, so I'm done. I found a matching of maximal size. Okay. So, the crucial thing is, how can I find, if I have a matching, how can I find an augmenting path? And the following corollary, which slightly ironically is notably longer than the theorem, is telling me about the existence of such augmenting paths. So the method is simply start with some matching, find an augmenting path if possible. If you find one, make you have a larger matching. So the only thing we need to do is find augmenting paths. And this corollary tells us about this. So let's suppose the size of the matching is strictly smaller than the size of a minimum vertex cover for minimum vertex cover C. Then there is an augmenting path. You might wonder, okay, but what is if I don't have, how do I get the minimum vertex cover? So in practice, you would actually make it slightly stricter. You would have to say, if you have a matching and a vertex cover, you either can produce a smaller vertex cover or you can find an augmenting path. And just to avoid it drowning in technicalities, I will assume that this vertex cover is of minimal size. It's not hard to modify the proof to deal with that situation that the vertex cover would be too large. There will be an obvious place where one would say, if that doesn't work well, then you can actually throw that vertex out of the cover. Okay. Right. So.
Wait, I have only 10 minutes.
Well. Okay. So. Okay, how am I going to do this? This proof is not... I don't think this is a proof which I'm going to get done in 10 minutes. Well, let me try to explain the idea. So, if the matching is smaller than the size of the minimum vertex cover, there must be one vertex which is not matched, right? Because we have more vertices than we have edges. And that's indeed what is happening here. We could, for example, have taken this vertex here, and it is not matched. And that's why I made, let's assume we don't have isolated vertices, so this vertex will be on an edge. So I can follow that edge. Okay. Well, if I follow that edge, if that vertex is also not, it's also a free vertex, I'm done. I have found two vertices which are free, which are connected by an edge. I get an augmenting path of length one edge, and that's the path. Simply, I add that edge to the matching. So, if that is not the case, if that is not free, it is matched, so it is adjacent to exactly one edge in the matching. So I follow and I go follow that edge in the matching. Okay. And what I now want is that I can say, now I want to do the same thing again. I want to say, go from this vertex on, there must be an edge which goes on from here, which is not in the matching, and which will go to, yeah, which will go to some vertex. Here it goes to a vertex which is free. If that vertex is free, I have the augmenting path. Otherwise, it is a vertex which is matched, and then I iterate that process. So that's how I will build this augmenting path. And what I essentially need to show is, and that's where I need the minimum vertex cover, that I must have that such an edge must exist. And I will do so by, well, in this case, my vertex cut, this is not exactly the situation because this wasn't, yeah, sorry. So in the example, I would have had to pick a vertex. I have also the case that's actually what I have in this example. So why do I have a free vertex? So there is a second case I need to deal with, that the vertex cover is larger, but two vertices are on the same edge of the matching. And then what I need to show is that I can move the vertices of the cover around and get that situation away. So, but that's not something I can do in 4 minutes, and I ran over a couple of times. So I think I stop at this place and we'll be back next time. Thank you very much.